Your Honor. May I approach?
You may approach.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lyle Koenig. I appear in this cause on behalf of Jan Litholin. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal time. Of course, as you all know, we are asking the court to adopt a new cause of action in the state of Nebraska. There is a wonderful law review article. It's the West Virginia Law Review, Volume 104. It's written in 2001 by Professor Diane Klein, which I think does a good job of defining the distinction between the probate process and the tort process. She says in her law review article that the probate process focuses on the rights of the testator to make the disposition he or she desires with her property during his or her lifetime, whereas the tort looks to the tortfeasor's intent and highlights or seeks to prevent or correct the wrongful conduct of the tortfeasor. So there's a distinction. Appellees.
Well, before you go any further, counsel, would you tell me what you believe is the issue in this case?
I think the issue is whether or not one can bring a cause of action for tortious interference with an expected inheritance, and I think a secondary issue, or maybe it's equal in importance, is whether or not we should have been allowed to amend our pleading. The court ruled on page 26 of the transcript, and if you'll allow me, I'll quote it. He says that the court finds that such cause of action cannot be amended. Therefore, it grants the defendant's motion to dismiss as to claims 2 and 3 with prejudice. No amendment is allowed. As this court is well aware, we have liberal pleading rules under notice pleadings, and I think we should have been allowed to amend. Because I think I could have amended and satisfied the court's concern.
Did you file a motion to amend or make?
We did not, Your Honor. I recognize that the appellees make a big deal out of that in their brief, but as I just read the language from Judge Bryan's order, I would have felt ridiculous after he said I can't amend, coming in with a motion to amend. What was he going to say? He would say, Mr. Koenig, I told you you can't amend, you can't amend. It seemed to me that a motion to amend would have been literally frivolous. So,
Mr. Koenig,
yes, sir.
This business about amending,
yeah.
If the trial court was correct that this cause of action that you're seeking to have us recognize does not exist in Nebraska. In other words, if you lose on the existence of the tort,
yes.
How could you have amended your complaint in any meaningful way? Or could you?
I probably couldn't.
So that issue is subsumed in.
It is.
Into the primary
it
issue.
It is. There's no question about that.
Would you have had a cause of action against the individual based on the actions that the individual took as the attorney in fact?
No.
Why not?
Because any kind of attack upon his actions as a power of attorney, in my judgment, would have been frivolous. And the reason it was is that he sold the land. He had the power of attorney. He had the ability to sell the land under the power of attorney. He did so, and he sold it for a good faith purchaser for value. So
he deposited it in the bank account of the now deceased individual, which deposit resulted in a benefit to himself as the attorney in fact.
That's true.
Isn't that presumptively fraudulent?
Well...
Wouldn't you have a cause of action against him for his fraudulent activities that he did in selling the property and depositing the money into an account which would directly benefit him?
Well, my theory is...
I know what your theory is, but...
I didn't think that I had the ability to do that. As I read the law from around the country, I thought that the way to approach this was with this tort. I will tell you, and I don't know that it is apparent from the record, but Judge Bryan also said that there were other remedies that I had available, namely constructive trust. I brought the constructive trust action in the county court, as he directed me to do. We brought a previous will contest. Every other thing that we tried in this case was unsuccessful. So my view is that...
You mean you're telling me that all your actions in the county court and the probate have been unsuccessful in all of those?
That's right. That's right. The judge, if you read Judge Bryan's order, he directed me to bring the constructive trust action in the county court of Gage County, and if the judge wouldn't take jurisdiction of that, to bring it back to him. So I brought it in the county court. We had both sides filed a motion for summary judgment. The judge granted summary judgment against me in favor of the defendants in that case, or the co-personal representatives, and so that proceeding failed as well.
And no appeal was taken from that?
No.
And none of this is in our record?
No, that's not in your record, but that is what happened.
And under what theory can we even take notice of that?
Well, you mean of something that's not in your record? I'm not sure you can.
Well,
but it's still the fact.
You can't take judicial notice of the judgments and proceedings of the court?
Well, I think you can take judicial... I know you can take judicial notice of your own rulings. I don't know if you can take judicial notice or not of rulings by the courts, but if you can, I suppose today you can certainly learn of it and just get on justice and see it. But
so you're telling me your only theory in this case now is whether or not there's an action for tort involving the intentional interference with a future inheritance.
That's right.
And if you don't have that action, then you're done, right?
I believe so. That's my position.
It's your claim that we should recognize that. So.
It is our claim. That is my claim. And I have several reasons for that. In fact, there are about eight of them. Number one, all of our border states have done so with the exception of Wyoming. I don't know that there's any good reason not to do so. I think we need it in Nebraska, as the facts of this case show, because there's no other remedy.
But there are other remedies. You just weren't successful. And whether it's in the record or not, it appears that you did bring other causes of action. And so you did have your day in court. And that seems to me that the appellee is arguing that we don't need this new cause of action because there's other remedies which you have already exercised.
There is a remedy that is absent, Your Honor, and it deals with the specific set of facts that we have in this case. As I said...
You have only one remedy. You're just arguing you've got several theories of recovery, and you lost on a couple of those theories of recovery in the county court, and now you're seeking to proceed on another theory of recovery in the district court.
Well,
you're only entitled to one relief.
Well,
And you say you've tried those theories in the county court, and they didn't work. Now you've got this tort theory in the district court.
Well, Your Honor, we're talking about two different things, as I discussed with my opening remark, and I think this is will address Justice Connolly's question as well. The law of wills doesn't apply to this case. So the will contest didn't apply because we were seeking no, we sought no.
You didn't object to the will.
Beg pardon?
You didn't object to the will.
We did.
What did you object to about the will?
We brought a will contest, although the will contest was brought by somebody else, by the sister of my client. My client didn't bring that will contest because there's a provision in the will that said if she did, that she got disinherited. So her sister brought it. We thought that her sister had a ground, but that was unsuccessful. As I told you, we also brought the constructive trust case. That was unsuccessful. But we have unique facts here, Your Honor. We have a situation where somebody, through the use of his power of attorney, sold $1 million worth of land. Then he turned around and deposited that money in accounts that he and his sister were going to inherit. And by doing that, what they did was simply rob my client of her inheritance. If the will had been, if the land had not been sold, my client would have inherited the land under the will. So what they did was, through the use of this procedure, circumvent the will and...
Didn't you argue that in the county court?
We did.
Mr. Koenig, had a conservator been appointed for this person who's now deceased, and the conservator sold the land, and let's even assume with court approval, the same result by depositing the proceeds of sale of the land in the soon-to-be deceased person's name only, the same result would have resulted, wouldn't it?
No.
It would have...
No, it would, for this reason, Your Honor. The reason, if the money had not been deposited in these two specific accounts, for example, if they'd opened up a separate account and put the money in that account, my client would have gotten it, because she gets the residue under the will. So you see, this was not a coincidence. When Mr. Juergens sold the real estate, then took the money and put it into two accounts that he and his sister were going to inherit, he knew what he was doing. If he'd taken the money and put it in a separate account, a new account, my client would have gotten it because she gets the residue under the will. And, I believe that you ought to adopt this tort because much of this involves questions of fact, and if you adopt the tort and give us a chance to prove it, I think a trier of fact, I think would find that this was a tortious interference with an expected inheritance. And I might say that under the cases that we have cited to you, specifically the case of Doughty versus Morris, it identifies the five elements that I have to prove. I can prove, all of those elements under this story.
Under these, the facts in your case as they presently exist, after that transaction occurred, if the person who gave the power of attorney, the ultimate decedent, had brought an action against her agent for breach of fiduciary duty, would that have been a successful cause of action?
I don't think so, because he had the authority under the power of attorney to do what he did.
No. His actions when he deposited the money in the account, which then gave him an interest in that account, was fraud per se. Was a prima facie case of fraud. An attorney, in fact, who sells property and benefits from the sale of that property, that's a prima facie case of fraud.
But there's one more step, Your Honor, and that is this. He didn't benefit until Mrs. Juergens died, because you see,
About when you had to bring your cause of action. I'm just talking about what your cause of action could have been under the status as a suit against the attorney in fact.
How would we have had standing to bring the action on the basis of fraud because he hadn't received anything yet? He didn't receive anything until she died, and then he inherited the account.
He succeeded as joint tenant.
Yes. Well, no, the will gives him, no, the will gives he and his sister the 2/3 of the account, gives my client 1/3 of the account. I'd like to reserve my 15 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Spray, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am J.L. Spray. I'm appearing today with my partner, Patty Van Ooy, on behalf of the Appellees, Gary Juergens and Velda Lenners. I want to address the question first about issue, and I think the issue of the case is really whether this court is going to adopt the new tort and the proper theory of recovery. I do want to cover some of the procedural and factual background first, then address the reasons this court should not adopt the new tort, and then why this particular case fails in any event. The decedent, Etta Juergens, died January 2, 2013 at the age of 92. Her will was dated November 4, 2004. It was offered for probate in the county court, after which objections were filed, and the matter was removed to the district court. The district court, through Judge Paul Korsland, entered summary judgment in favor of the 2004 will and against the objectors. The plaintiff appellant, Litherland, then filed this action. She had already raised the identical...
Excuse me, but what was the objection to the will? Was it undue influence?
Undue influence and mental capacity, both. And at the trial...
But that dealt with the execution of the will in 2004.
Correct, Your Honor.
That didn't have anything to do with the transfer or sale of this real estate by, is it Juergens?
Yes, and it did.
Under a power of attorney, which would be... at that time a cause of action for fraud when a power of attorney or attorney in fact sells property and places it into an account that he's going to have a beneficial interest in?
Yeah, I want to be clear.
Isn't that a prima facie evidence of fraud?
I don't think so in this case, and here's why, Your Honor. At least it's rebuttal. The facts are, and you have to kind of tease them out of the attachments to Exhibit 1, but the account wasn't joint with right of survivorship. The account was Etta Juergens' personal account. No one else was on it. No one else was POD. So it was hers. So the land, which was all hers with no joint tenants, was sold, and the money was put into her account. When Mr. Juergens did that, he had no knowledge of her will, either that he was going to inherit that bank account, which was a specific bequest, or the specific devise of the land. He didn't know. So I think, at a minimum, the fraud's rebuttal.
Okay.
Now, the action was raised in the undue influence in that context of the original objection to the will. Discovery was done, and all these facts came out, and the bank accounts were disclosed. The appellants would have had an opportunity to figure out exactly what happened and bring the appropriate cause of action.
But that wouldn't have been a cause of action for undue influence with regard to execution of the will in 2004, would it? Activity that occurred that created the cause of action wherever was the sale of the land, because under her will, that land went to Litherland.
Right.
Or Litherland, and so had that land not been sold and the deceased will was then probated, she would have inherited that part of the
right.
That's
one of the things I think has to be addressed by the court is whether a living person can have a will and heirs, and whether those heirs then have an expectancy. If I write a will at age 20 and leave my estate to my brother, and then at age 80 I have children and grandchildren, I've changed it. Has someone interfered with my brother's expectancy that he was going to inherit under my old will? I don't know, but that's the kind of slippery slope we go down when we get out of the framework of the probate code and the framework of the fraud common law theories. This case is really a constructive fraud case, if anything. And I think, in some respects...
Because all that happened was a moving of the assets from one form to another. The property as it existed as land was going to go to one individual alone. But when the property was sold and placed into the account of the estate, then it was going to be divided among three individuals.
Correct. And the idea that this woman didn't know what she was doing and directing, because the facts, again, not before you, but the facts are, there's a significant dispute over whether she was controlling what her attorney, in fact, was doing, and he was merely doing the legwork for her.
Well, that would have to be ferreted out in the factual situation as to whether she consented to that transfer or not.
Correct, but the key fact is...
Excuse me, so your take on it is this correct, that at the time the will was done, there's no undue influence? Is that
correct?
Right? And the way you read the will is, and when I die, the land goes to X if land there be.
Right. And the statute, the probate...
Upon death?
Yes.
In other words, if land there be upon my death?
At the time of my death in the future.
Okay.
Unless I change my will.
Is that an instruction in and of itself? Or is it superseded by the power of attorney, which attorney has some fiduciary duties to preserve the corpus and stuff like that?
Let me take me back to a question Justice Castle asked about a conservatorship, and I don't know if he was tapping around this issue or not, but the common law, and there's a great opinion by Justice Stephen Emery in the state of Bauer, the common law is that if you put a specific device in your will, and then that property goes away for whatever reason.
Like a designated asset.
That's right. It's a redemption by revocation.
Okay.
The Bauer case said, okay, there's a statute. A little bit confusing, but there's a statute where the probate code comes in and amends the common law by saying, here are certain circumstances where a redemption by revocation doesn't happen. One of them is if you have a conservator sell the property. Another one is if the property gets blown away in a tornado and there's insurance proceeds.
So that the designated asset can be eclipsed by thus and so.
Right.
Okay.
The Bauer decision specifically says powers of attorney don't apply to that. And the reason is, and I think Judge Brian got exactly to this in his order, the reason is the person who gave the power of attorney actually gave the specific authority to her attorney, in fact, to do exactly what he did. She gave him authority to sell her real estate. Now, let's think about that. If she didn't want that real estate sold because of her will, she didn't have to give him that authority, but she did. And she gave him authority to manage her bank accounts and to add assets to them and to take assets out of them.
But when an attorney, in fact, sells property that results in a benefit, there is a presumption of fraud.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. But I think it's rebuttable. And I think...
But somewhere that action could have been decided.
I think it was. I think the first theory in this case is couched sort of as a constructive trust, but it really is constructive fraud because it talks about the fiduciary status, the confidential relationship. I think that's your constructive fraud case.
Again, with fraud, you'd have to show that he knew what the will
correct
said.
Absolutely. And that wasn't pled. So Judge Brian, on the jurisdictional issue, took that constructive fraud, or arguably what is a constructive fraud case. He said, look, you can deal with this in the county court, you can deal with it here, you guys decide. The county court kept jurisdiction. And then he went on to provide that the will, or the contest there was just going to be involved in the second and third causes of action or theories. And he found that this theory wasn't met. He didn't find, as Mr. Koenig argues, that the theory doesn't exist or isn't actionable. He said, okay, here are the elements I think that are there, and you don't meet them because, one, you didn't plead knowledge of the bad actor.
Well, but could that have been amended in a pleading? Could he have amended and pled knowledge?
Sure.
Why isn't that an abuse of discretion not to allow him to amend?
Because he wasn't asked for leave to allow him to amend.
He didn't ask for it. Is that the reason? I mean, you would agree he could have alleged constructive fraud in this case and alleged that the attorney, in fact, knew of the will and therefore by performing that act and depositing that money or selling the real estate and depositing it, that was a prima facie case of fraud that would then shift the burden to the attorney, in fact.
And in the world of notice pleading, when I read that first theory, that's how I took it. That this was sort of like Crosby versus Lures, which I think is the constructive fraud case in the state, and that he actually bit that apple and took it. The judge just, it ended up in the county court to be tried, not in the district court. I don't think there's any error raised on that. But the issue of the court's decision not to allow him to amend, I think the first hurdle is that this court has said you've got to ask to amend before we're going to you know, a court doesn't have a duty just to automatically allow you to amend, and of course it's in the sound discretion.
And that's the trend under the federal cases.
It is. And you know, I thought I had a tab.
We may not have said that.
Yes.
That's the trend under the federal cases.
And I think this court has adopted that, and I can't put my hands on it.
Okay.
You know, we're juggling hundreds of cases here when you look at the multiple jurisdictions. So getting back to the argument.
So I understand it is the plaintiff's theory was one theory in the district court and one theory, basically, that was a tort of intentional interference with a future inheritance.
Right.
Court didn't recognize that, and counsel didn't ask leave to amend and dismiss the case.
There were three theories in the complaint. One was requested a constructive trust be imposed because of the confidential relationship, which I took to be a constructive fraud case, the abuse of the power of attorney. The second was the intentional interference with the inheritance expectancy, and then the third was the conspiracy. Now, just to touch on the conspiracy while I'm here.
But he's really not appealing anything but the denial of the tort of intentional interference.
He assigned error on the tortious interference on the leave to amend and then also on the conspiracy. I think that's the fifth assignment of error.
But he didn't assign his error the leave to amend under a constructive trust theory.
He assigned his error denial of leave to allow him to amend. Now, I don't know what his amendment might have been.
You know, Mr. Koenig says, well, he didn't file a motion to amend. How did the subject of amendment come up?
Well, Judge Bryan's, the Bill of Exceptions, Judge Bryan had a dialogue with us about a number of things in the course of the argument. I don't remember amendments specifically coming up, but the order's fairly explicit that he didn't want anybody to file a motion to amend. He didn't prohibit anybody from filing a motion to amend. And it seems like if Judge Bryan missed the boat, he should have come back and on some kind of motion, whether it's a new trial or a motion to amend or leave for to amend or something before the case.
Was that something Judge Bryan raised on his own without anybody discussing it or bringing it up?
I think that's right.
What public policy reasons, why shouldn't we recognize cause of action for interference, tortious interference here?
I would have two pretty clear responses to that. One, there's no need. And it's simply all these issues that are addressed in this case, and I think in most cases, are either handled under the probate code. So for instance, this redemption issue. If Mr. Koenig, on behalf of his client, wanted to argue that this was an redemption by revocation and that she was entitled to the proceeds, it was certainly under the jurisdiction of the probate court to raise that issue. And then this constructive fraud case could have easily been brought. What's the purpose? And the second reason is it's a slippery slope. Go back to my example, and you know, my law partner tells me never do analogies, but you know, I write a will when I'm 20, and when I'm 80, circumstances change. When do you draw that line? And especially in the case of a will. Now, there are instances where the courts have adopted the tort for some specific reasons, like somebody goes into the safety deposit box and tears up the will, and there's no remedy under the probate code, or they suppress it. There are even cases where they use this tort for undue influence. But we already have that, so there's no need. And then in the case of a will, if you subscribe to the theory that a living person has no will, and that their last will and testament doesn't happen until the instant of death, and that they have the right to change their will and under the probate code to have the state of Nebraska enforce it.
The mirror image of that is an expectation, isn't a right.
Correct. And it really isn't. And to supplant the decedent's intentions, which may be secret to her, no one in the world may know her true intentions, by judicial fiat and to override the authority of the legislature and the probate code just seems like a step too far to me.
And your example of the tearing up of the will, you wouldn't need the tort because the constructive fraud theory would apply and
correct.
The trust would be imposed. And
I, I think there's a statute, and I even thought of it this morning, I didn't look it up, so I can't cite it, that imposes a duty on the lawyers and the heirs at law to produce the will at death and to at least deliver it to the probate court. So I think that issue really is answered.
The heirs at statutory heirs.
Correct. Heirs at law.
Heirs at
law. I just want to touch on the conspiracy because it was assigned. That, of course, is dependent on another tort existing, which it doesn't in this case. And then I go back to the complaint, which is incomplete in this respect.
You may finish your thought.
It's incomplete in this respect because it doesn't make a single allegation about the co-conspirator Bell the lender. So I don't see how you could see with the conspiracy theory. So for those reasons, we had asked that the court affirm the dismissal of Judge Bryant. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
We have 15 seconds.
15 seconds. Mr. Koenig, we will give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel tells you that Mr. Juergens had no knowledge of the will. That's not true. Through discovery, we discovered that she showed him a copy of the will. There is a dispute over when, there's going to be a dispute over when he knew the contents of the will, but I can prove that he knew the contents of the will before he sold the land. But that's my point. If we have a tort and I can go forward with this, that is something for a trier of fact to determine. And I haven't been given the opportunity to do that. So that's what we're asking you to do, is to recognize the tort and allow us to go forward. I think there is a crying need for the tort of interference with an expected inheritance, and I think the facts of this case illustrate that. So I would ask you to reverse this, to return it, thank you.
What do you want to return?
Your Honor, my request is that you reverse this case. Permit us to amend our pleading and allow us to go forward with the case to prove tortious interference with an expected inheritance. That's our request. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is Ficke versus Wolken. And Mr. Koenig, you are arguing this also. Yes, you may approach, but let's give everybody a